the second full day and night of our retreat together. Bringing everything back to the mother, to the source, though we might think I'm moving through the retreat. Actually, this retreat is moving through the heart. The first day of the retreat, the arriving. That's now a memory. That memory, any image we can have of arriving, orienting ourselves, perhaps being anxious, perhaps reacting to the newness, the echoes from what we came from. Those memories arise and cease right in this present moment. Any ideas we have about what's to come, speculations, anxieties about how it will be tomorrow, next week, next year. The unknown hasn't happened yet. We know from this mother of all conditions, from this place of awareness, we know the memories as they come and go. We know the speculations about the future as they arise. As our teacher used to say again and again and again, now is the knowing. Now we can know what's arising and ceasing. The world arises and ceases within this awareness. Right now, the sense of being in a room with a lot of people. That perception arises in the heart. Perception, second day of our retreat. How many more days to go? That arises, that perception, vivid, moves through the heart. The perceptions change. Morning, midday, evening. Cold and rain. Now clear, cool. Can we get the sense of conditions which move through the heart? Can we begin to get the sense of that which remains? The sounds, for example, of my voice arise and cease. But underlying the sounds, before the sounds, after the sounds, amidst the silence, what remains? Isn't there that listening, at knowing. Sounds come and go. Perceptions come and go. Sense of succeeding and failing wells up and subsides. Feeling peaceful, feeling agitated, feeling bored, inspired, confused. What knows these states? How do we know when we're confused? Is that which recognizes confusion confused? Yet we can so often feel, I'm confused. I've lost my inspiration. I'm just so restless and agitated. And consciousness collapses around. And there's that sense of being defined by what moves through the heart. We become that. And then get moved by the conditions. Or as the masters say, we get turned by the conditions. Confusion comes and we get turned by it. Desire comes and we get turned by it, moved by it, swept away by it. When we identify with it, assume that it's me. What happens when we recognize it for what it is, a visitor, a guest? Something moving through this spaciousness of knowing. The form, the limitation of our meditation helps facilitate this recognition that these conditions are guests. That's why they're just skillful means. There's nothing ultimate about it. It's just a tool. But this is why it's helpful to have sitting periods, walking periods, where one consciously binds oneself. That's the root of the word religio. It means binding. Religion was meant to be. Yoga, similarly, was meant to be a binding, a conscious binding. We consciously tie ourselves to what looks from the outside like a limitation. Why? In sitting, and we bind ourselves to this posture. Steadying ourselves in presence and awareness. Rooting ourselves, perhaps, in the experience of the body, sitting, breathing, cultivating a sense of ease of being here. Then perhaps we notice a restlessness. Doesn't feel good, hemmed in. There's so many others in here. Air's not so good. Air would be better out there. I'd be free out there. I could enter peacefulness out there. Perhaps. Now, it might be the case that when we believe that thought, and it might be a true thought, I'm not going to argue that. But when we believe that thought, we get moved by that thought out the door. Literally. We're moved by it because it's me. And it seems like freedom. Might be. We're free to do what we want. But we tend to get moved by it. It seems so solid. But many of us have been moving on our views and opinions for 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, 50 years, 60 years, 70 years. And some of us, I was 24 and I felt 104. When I went off to the monastery, I felt 24. I had been following the thoughts that were me. What I wanted, I went after. What I didn't want, I pushed away. And I got some things. Got my hand, I wanted to be a wrestling champion. So I did 500 press-ups a day, and I climbed ropes, and I walked on my hands. I could walk on my hands for 50 yards, even longer. Climb ropes. We even had a wrestling mat at home. Wrestling, y'all know the word wrestling? Mm-hmm. Wrestling. Jacob wrestling the angel. First image of meditation. Yes. A classic. I didn't know at the time, but that it had such a noble history. That in wrestling one can struggle with the unknown and eventually Israel. One can overcome through that struggle. But I'm getting ahead of myself. In the old days, I was just wrestling to become a champion. And I even got to the point where I won this championship I wanted. I wanted to win this national championship. And even got to the point where I won it, and my hand was lifted up. I had worked for years. And that's not a bad thing. It's a lovely thing. But I've worked for years thinking, when I get there, then yes. Exhilaration. I'm a national champion. But he didn't keep my hand up that long. My mother, bless her soul, had pictures and scrapbooks, and whenever I would go home, I could see the trophies and the pictures, and I could open up all the things. But you can only look at scrapbooks for so long. And your hand didn't stay up that long. And 5 minutes later, I was already worrying about who's coming back next year. Who do I have to wrestle next year? Accomplishment's not bad. I'm not saying it's bad, but there was it's like when I first met Ajahn Chah, the great Thai master. I wanted him to tap me on the head. I'd heard of enlightened beings and enlightenment, light, I figured that was something to do with light. And I wanted him to, one, recognize my potential. After all, I must have some potential. I wanted him to do it, tap me. And he asked me, well, what do you know about meditation? Well, I've had a 10-day retreat. Just talking some about my meditation. And then he was saying, well, then what are you going to do after that? What are you going to do after you meditate? Well, I'll probably go to medical school. And then, well, I'll go be a doctor. And what after are you going to do about that? And, and then after that, then what are you going to do? And he lifted up this spittoon. He chewed this stuff called betel nut and spit into it. And then what are you going to do after that? And he would put his finger going around in the circle and around and around and around and around. I didn't really get it. I'm starting to get it. Success. What about next year? Getting a little more peaceful. God, where did it go? Getting closer, closer, closer. Maybe tomorrow, maybe tomorrow. And a breakthrough tomorrow. Oh, gee, if only that person wasn't snoring next to me. Round and round and round. The Buddha said something about this. We just keep going, going, going. Which do you think is more, said the Buddha? The flood of tears which weeping and wailing you have shed upon this long way, hurrying and hastening through this round of rebirth, united with the unloved, means meeting up with what we don't want. United with the unloved. Separated from the loved. When we get separated from what we want. I'm a champion. Lost it. With the beloved. Where have they gone? United with the unloved, separated from the loved. Which do you think is more, this flood of tears or the water of the four oceans? Long have you suffered the death of father and mother, sons, daughters, brothers, sisters. While you were thus suffering, you have indeed shed more tears upon this long way than there is water in the four oceans. Inconceivable is the beginning of this samsara. Not to be discovered is any first beginning of beings who, obstructed by ignorance, ensnared by craving, are hurrying and hastening through this round of rebirth. Thus, have you long undergone suffering, undergone torment, undergone misfortune, filled the graveyards full? Truly, long enough to be dissatisfied with all the forms of existence, long enough to turn away and free yourself from them all. It's talking about not a hating anything, but a weariness, a helpful weariness that the Buddha called nibbitta, a sense of, like when we're sitting here and I was talking about the restlessness and this and that, yes, we can rush out and see this and rush out and see that, get swept by all these desires and aversions. Then we rush outside to be free, and then it seems a bit cold. Oh, it might be a little bit warmer inside. Then we sit inside, it's warmer, and we feel cooped up. Then we go outside to feel free, and then we feel a bit tired. And we think, oh, that was a mistake. I probably should have stayed a little bit longer to get more peaceful. Then we go inside. It's endless. Yet in staying by religio, binding ourselves to a practice, we have the opportunity, and I'm sure you've experienced this, have opportunity to have welling up the desire to move away, or the aversion to something, the aversion to the body, or the aversion to sensation, or the desire for something else. By staying with it, we have the opportunity to see it well up, and then shift, and then change, and begin to have the possibility of having the insight that these things are actually guests. They're not definitions of what we are. Yes, they're an aspect of our being. When we identify with them and we get moved by them, then we are limited by that desire, that aversion, that mood. When we have the opportunity to be still and inquire and see it well up and see it subside, then we think, what was that all about? We were restless and then it's gone. We were angry and then it's gone. We were agitated and then it's gone. So one of the images that the Buddha gave that can be very helpful is to remember that we're like a guest house. And to know the difference between the host and the guest. The guest comes, stays for a while, then moves on. The host remains. Start to get the feeling of that which moves through. Get the feeling of what remains. We've been practicing cultivating the capacity to steady the attention, to direct through skill, vitakka, directing the attention to be here, vichara, to explore that which moves through this here, the forms, the in-breath, the out-breath, the sights, the sounds, the smells, the taste, the touches. We've been encouraging ourselves to learn how to savor it, to be filled with that quality of being with the body, to relax with it, to be unified with it. Not as an end in of itself, but as a skillful way to cultivate a blameless abiding. But ultimately, to realize that this abiding is also temporary. We get peaceful, perhaps. But if we think that we want to stay like that all the time, we suffer. I used to get depressed after every single retreat because I was a slow learner. I would get still, more calm. And then I would want to possess it. I'd want to be that way all the time. Then in talking and moving, get frustrated. It's a lovely skill, but if we want it that way all the time, there's still no wisdom And so in this practice, we're combining wisdom and the capacity for tranquility. When we find ourselves suffering, when we find ourselves not composed, the Buddha taught that there are these qualities which are hindering us. He taught us that it's very important to get to know these qualities, to understand them, that when we don't know them, we're possessed by them. We're confused by them. He said, when we don't understand these qualities, that then we're not able to fully be here. These are classical teachings, which many of you have heard many, many times, but we can keep contemplating them. The classical hindrances, those formations, which when we don't understand them, confuse us, our desire, wanting to be somewhere else, wanting something that's not here, and its cousin not wanting what's here, its first cousin, which is another kind of desire, really, wanting to get rid of stuff, wanting and not wanting. The third one is heaviness, dullness. We're sort of not really, we're more numb. Its twin is restlessness and worry, fretting. We can't really settle. That's number four. Number five is doubt. We're paralyzed by wondering, should I do this or should I do that? We're tangled up. When these subside, then we naturally are in samadhi. We naturally are in touch with how things are. So, on this retreat, we've been contemplating saying not now when things are disturbing us, just for the sake of developing some skill at being able to temporarily pause, temporarily relax, temporarily establish ourselves with some kind of basis of contemplation. This is not a permanent solution. It's skillful. It's like an army that's always on the front line. A good commander will know if an army is always on the front line, always fighting, getting exhausted. But it's not wise. That there's a skillful time to retreat, a skillful time to pull back, gather our strength, gather our resources. Come from a place of real stability, and then meet again that which is obstructing, meet again that which is confusing, meet again that which needs to be met. For those times when I used to get depressed after retreat, because I still was living in a fantasy, just wanting always to be peaceful. That's wanting, that's a hindrance. Not wanting to have anything painful contact me. That's another hindrance. Until I started reflecting that these hindrances need to be understood, need to be welcomed. Yes, we withdraw. But yes, we also need to be able to look at these things. So certainly in this part of the retreat, we'll be opening up the meditation much more to intuitively balancing, blending this steadying the heart, controlling, it's a kind of control, steadying the heart to be still and peaceful and quiet. Balancing that between that calming practice And also opening the heart to see what's disturbing us, what's causing suffering, what is hindering us. Actually, these are called traditionally samatha vipassana. Samatha means calming. Vipassana means insight into. Because they're two different words, sometimes it makes it sound like they're radically different activities. That's one of the problems of language. The nature of language. But actually they're intimately related. You can't have one without the other. You can't have vipassana. You can't look into the nature of things without some degree of samadhi. Like in science, if you have a microscope, and at least in the old days, now it's probably different. You're looking and focusing at something on a what do you call that, a slide, looking at a drop of water to look into what's in this drop of water, what microbes, what life forms are in there. You can focus into it, but you can't see into that if you can't keep your eyes steady. You can't get the equipment steady. You'll get a distorted picture. Vipassana, to look into something, requires a certain degree of steadiness. Also, we can't get steady. We can't get calm without a certain degree of wisdom. As we know, it's not enough just to say, calm down. You can just give the order. But I don't know. My body and emotions don't just follow orders. Maybe yours do. Shut up! I mean, you might shut up for a little while and cower. Gonna bully your body, bully your emotions. But that's probably not samadhi. That's not rapturous samadhi. It might be tense, waiting for the next being hit. It takes wisdom. That's why samadhi involves vitakka, a certain amount of will in directing, but it also involves vichara, adjusting, checking out where we're too tense, checking out where the effort's too strong. When the effort's too strong, it takes wisdom to say, hey, relax, calm down. Don't be in such a hurry. One step at a time. That's the voice of wisdom. Easy, steady, steady, yes, 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 yes. It takes wisdom also to get calm. So the Buddha described calm and insight as like two oxen pulling a plow. They work together. So yes, sometimes we say not now. But sometimes things are persistent. And they break through the not now and say now. And we find ourselves desiring something. We find ourselves averse, really upset about someone or something. They said this and they said that. Or restless. And it's important to not just feel like a failure. It's important then to use the samadhi we have to investigate this. Rather than just saying, I'm hindered, and feel all upset about it. Yes, there are, these can hinder us, but when we open to these qualities, then already then we're learning from them. That's different. It's one thing to totally identify with them. Then we're possessed by them. When we're the image the Buddha gave is like there's a stream running down a mountain. It picks up speed. Like imagine a stream running down a mountain with water. But imagine that someone is diverting the stream to pull water out the sides of the stream. The more the water is diverted, the current gets slower and slower. It won't be able to be swift enough to carry things all the way down the mountain. But if the streams that are pulling out the sides, if those are closed so that the stream flows down the mountain, the current gets quick, powerful. It can pull things all the way down. Similarly, the Buddha said, when we're not conscious of these hindrances, they restlessness and desire wanting this, averse to that, confused about this, paralyzed by that, it's like diverting the water of our power. And our energy can't take us deep. Doesn't take us deep, doesn't take us to the core. But when we start to reflect on these hindrances, start to question them, investigate them, start to learn what it means to be free of just wishing we were somewhere else, free of thinking, I just have to get rid of something. Then we can have the experience of our, of contacting the power of our being. Desire oftentimes makes us, it focuses out somewhere. And we're locked in here and we want to be on the beach. We want to be somewhere else where it's more fun, more interesting. Desire points to something out there. Rarely does desire look at itself. And we start to contemplate that energy. Contemplate that, where does it end? Always going somewhere else. Always going somewhere else. At what point do we remember that reading on samsara? Endlessly going somewhere else. At what point then do we actually look at the limitation of that energy? Start to question, who is this happening to? Is this me? It'll say yes. We can sit with it, noticing it well up, noticing it change. Maybe have a moment of noticing it subside. That which notices desire and listens to desire isn't desire. That which listens to aversion isn't aversion. That which listens to restlessness isn't restless. Even when we're heavy and dull, that which notices and knows the dullness isn't dull. If our attention is contracted and focused and identified and possessed by these things, then we get moved by them. By these practices, we learn to stay still enough to begin to see them shift. And very importantly is this this energy of doubt, this last one, very important. We so quickly identify with our thinking mind. Oh, I don't know if it's working. This method. This method might have been working 2,500 years ago, but I mean, that's a long time ago. I mean, really? I mean, and Kittisar and Tanisar are sweet enough. I mean, they don't understand, I mean, let's face it, they don't understand the Jewish mind. really. Maybe I should have gone to a Kabbalah retreat. But then, Kitty Searle's father is Jewish. He might have a little, he might have something there. But there's so many, I mean, we can tie ourselves up in wondering, should I, and doubt is useful, can be useful when it's an inquiry. But notice how a doubt is a thirst for a certainty. Should I say not now, or should I say now? But the not now. But what if my not now is premature, and I'm repressing, and maybe I'll explode. These are fair enough to think, but how often do we then notice what is happening? Can we dispassionately notice there's doubt? It seems like when we're in doubt that we need an answer, and that there's no certainty. But actually, we can know the doubt. We can know there is doubt. If we have to have certainty, gosh, that's deadly. It's really deadly. We have to have an answer. There's many people in the world that have answers. And they keep coming back to that certainty, and that certainty, and that certainty, and that certainty, and that rigidity, and that insensitivity. And though that looks like conviction, and looks like faith, and looks like strength, it's incredibly brittle. In Buddhist teaching, the capacity, the courage, the honesty to notice when there's something doubtful, and to know that, so that you're still abiding in knowing. You're still abiding in confidence, but the confidence that knows it as it is, knows the doubt. The doubt then doesn't shake the faith, because the faith is deeper than a view. It's deeper than an idea of my way's right, your way's wrong. Deeper than having to have an answer. Sometimes there isn't an answer yet. It's like when bread's cooking. Is it cooked yet? Is it cooked yet? Pull it out. Is it cooked yet? It's not cooked yet. But can we let things marinate sometimes? Some things marinate. Some things cook. Some things, I don't know. Allow the ingredients. Can we be honest enough to be able to say, I'm not sure what to do. But is that a waste of time? To be able to hang out with a doubtful situation? There's lots of doubt. There's lots of situations that are complex, that are confusing. But with a heart that's sensitive, a heart that's sensitive to pain and heartbreak, can we know the ease of knowing that, yes, this is how it is? So we're abiding in that serenity. But at the same time, with that serenity, we're feeling the pain of all the uncertainties, all the unanswered questions. But we're being honest. We're holding that. Then, in a sense, we're not being hindered, rather than it being me in doubt, me desiring an answer, me being averse. In a sense, it becomes dharma. It becomes the way things are. And the heart becomes wider, vaster. We're more open for things to move through the heart, rather than so quickly identifying and collapsing around this mood, this thought, this feeling. So this practice, so it is just a practice. There's nothing ultimate about it, but this practice of being still helps us start to recognize some of these guests as guests, to free them, to come and go, and to realize that some of these are, as our teacher called them, orphans of consciousness. Some of these moods and things we've just hated. We've just pretended they aren't there. We've just pushed them away, thinking we're done with them. We can think we're done with doubt by just putting armor on and clenching our jaw and always being confident. We can think we're done with it, but it's just shoved in the back room. People like that, when they get sick and get weak, then feel totally possessed and overwhelmed. These orphans of consciousness, our teachers encouraged us to, rather than being overwhelmed by them, there's a place in our meditation, yes, sometimes for not now, for gathering, stabilizing. And then with that little bit of strength, there's a time for welcoming and getting to know these orphans as part of nature, getting to know the doubts, getting to know the despairs that we used to feel are just me. Oh, I'll never get there. We all have Buddha nature but me. And rather, one extreme is just believe and get lost in it. Another extreme is just knock it away. As the British would say, you know, stiff upper lip and all that. But the middle way is to know, to be the Kuan Yin, to abide as that mother of dharmas. And allow this unwanted formation to be heard, to be recognized, let it move, let it wail, let it come up, and then notice that it naturally subsides and wells up and subsides. From a position of wisdom, position of compassion, we start to lose it and really feel like we're being overwhelmed. Okay, we turn the volume up a little more on steadiness of heart. We regroup. We just go to the body. We go to the breath. We go to steps one at a time. And then if there's something powerful, then little by little we sense how it feels in the body. We sense how it's easy to get lost in it. So that little bit by little we're investigating, understanding these desires and longings and aversions and restlessnesses, and beginning to see them rather than as me, as changing, as guests that come and go. And we'll then have moments of realizing the that they aren't what we thought they were. And in moments of seeing that everything that arises ceases. In moments of seeing that there's nothing that can be ultimately grasped. Then we'll be free to allow conditions to move and get a sense of that spaciousness, that silence, that ever-present listening that remains, that is our true home, that is where we've always already been, that is the I am that I am. But at some point we realize the sacred, there's sacred signs out there, but at some point we realize we have the source of all that is sacred. We merge with all that is sacred right at the core of our being. We can explore this. And ultimately our wisdom will see that every condition, happy and unhappy, arises and ceases, leaving this quality of inner listening. So in these next few days, we won't throw away our calming practices. We'll still allow ourselves to enjoy and be at peace when there's peace. But we'll also begin to turn the volume up a little bit on really having the time to investigate what disturbs, to investigate even the piece itself and realize that it's flickering, shifting, and changing. And in the next days, coming days, we'll get the feeling for developing the compassion and the ability to hold all these conditions. And that as we hold them, we little by little allow them to transform themselves into stillness, into peacefulness. And rather than being in a big hurry to solve everything, I encourage us just to have a big picture for the rest of our life, however that long that might be. For the rest of our life, may we just use moment after moment to get a little more patient, a little more willing to be with how things are, a little more able. To receive the teachings that each moment is offering us. Finishing a perfect day. This day begins and it ends just like all conditions do. And though we might not know it, we cultivated many blessings today just trying to be patient with this body and mind. The blessing of just not trying to harm anyone today. The blessing of making the effort to skillfully use this body-mind to cultivate some ease that's blameless. Might not seem like much, but in a world of so much insanity, so much violence. It's my deep belief that what we're doing is very significant. So may we at least feel this blessing of our noble effort. And to finish this day, may we offer the blessings of our life. May that touch every cell in our body as we relax. May it be shared with each other in this room, because ultimately we're not separate. May it flow into our families, our parents, whether they're here in this world or in another, ancestors, our community, our friends, our enemies. May our enemies be touched. May our enemies leave behind that which is harmful. May those beings which are powerful leave behind that which is deluded. May those beings which are hateful, may their plans fail. May they have a change of heart. May the goodness of our life mysteriously just through a gift, a quiet gift, may the goodness of our life mysteriously touch all beings for the welfare of all beings. Using Kuan Yin's mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum, just four words. Om honors the totality. Mani means the jewel of the pure heart. Padme means lotus, the many petals, the many manifestations of life, which all arise and merge back into this pure heart. Hum means so be it. Oh.